might recognize some of the authors.
How far is Basu?
She's virtually here.
What's that?
She's waited another few minutes.
I'm not sure.
First author I'd like to introduce you to is Dr. Yoni Grossman. Anybody who went to McDonald's, maybe in the 50s. Another thing he often comes to America in the summertime, early summer. It's during COVID, but he stays on the west side, so I become close to him. And this, I must say, the book is written in Hebrew and it's difficult Hebrew. But the mivne of the book is really this course. Okay? Now, I've been teaching the course for 35 years at Yeshiva University, so I didn't check up with him about how to work the material. But he starts with an introduction and he talks about how we use words, how the Torah and Tanakh chooses its words to make a subtle point. Just the great gift of this book is that his examples are very worthwhile. And it's about the Sipur. The book is called Galui Umutzpan. Galui Umutzpan. Hidden and the revealed. Okay? The assumption is something I've been saying a number of times in this class, is that the Tanakh wants so badly for you to be a partner in what it wants to impart, right? Much more than Shakespeare, much more than the novel. The novel has to spell things out for you. A spy thriller has to leave some things for the thrill of, oh, that's what it was. Oh, my goodness. Right? But the Tanakh wants so badly for you to be a partner in what is being said. It's not going to tell you, how did these guys get out of the palace with the king's head? It's going to give you one word or one inconsistency, and you work with it. You find it. That's the mutzpan. You get it? So I'm just going to give you some examples that just come to my head right now. Right? In Shmuel Aleph, Perek Bet, right, it speaks about how the wickedness of Eli's sons, right? You all know what they were, first thing they besides the fact that they were Yishtavuinis Hanoshim Pesach Olam Moed? What? The Kohen Gadol's sons are Yishtavuinis, you know, I don't know if that involves permission or not. I mean, what? In front of the Olam Moed, this is what the Kohen Gadol says. Right? Chazal, sort of, maybe you know the Gemara Shabbos that talks about all the people who never really sinned. Kolom Edavin Chotor Edo Latoa, Kol Shlomo Chotor Edo Latoa, Ruben Chotor Edo Latoa, Kol Edavin. So I think there's sort of a morality play there between Ruben and the sons of Eli. What did Reuven essentially do to his father, according to the famous Gemara? Rashi brings it down, so he must know it. What did he actually do? Which I think is deeply problematic, because the Pasuk says, Vayishkav is Bilha. And you're telling me that you didn't actually do what's written in the Pasuk. Where else can I do something like that? Did the flood happen? Okay, yes, but what did he do? He moved the bed. From whose tent to whose tent? Bila's tent to Leah's tent after Rachel died. And Chazal actually are quite proud of what he did. Right? He gets a pass until Yaakov on his deathbed. Right? He gets a pass because what was his motivation? His mother's respect. I can picture You know, Reuven says, I can allow my mother to play second fiddle to her younger sister, Rachel, but I will not allow her to play second fiddle to her handmaiden. Reuven, that's not your decision. So whatever he actually did to her, it was denying Yaakov some conjugal rights with his own wife. It's not your decision. So do you see, you ever hear what did B'nai Eli do to the women? You ever hear? You've seen? It's Rashi.
They were.
It's a Gemara.
In fact, they not to give her first.
Yeah, when the women had gave birth and had to bring their korban to eat kachim again, and not to be told. No, she's Torah well before bringing that korban. That korban is brought after 40 days for a boy, 80 days for a girl. It has nothing to do with Torah. That's what the Karaites say. This was like a big polemic in the Middle Ages between the Karaites and Sadigon. Right? So it's not about Torah. But anyway, by being lazy about who gets to, they were busy on kachim was their problem. So by denying these women a quick, speedy return to their homes where they can be reunited with their husbands, get it? It's something like Reuven. Okay. I often use these gemaras when I teach rabbanim how to teach kollel classes, not chassidim classes. The men teach chassidim classes. My wife teaches the kollel classes. And I tell them, when you get a shayla, taras mishpacha, you answer in a minute. You drop everything to answer that question. Chas v'shalom, because you didn't answer on time. That her answer was, you go tomorrow night instead of tonight. Because look what this Gemara says about stuff like that. That's what's going on. It's crucial to really appreciate what goes on with Midrashim. Because the Medrash's agenda is not necessarily to tell you what happened. Medrash's agenda is to tell you how to read the biblical text and live the best life you can as a result. Now, that's plain with the Torah's box. What else can we do? Good intentions. Because I'll give Reuven a pass. So I'm digressing, because when the sons of Eli commit their awful sin with the Vizion Kachim, they're just going to write a few words on the board, I'm going to write it in a place where you can see it. Okay? It says that they stuck a fork, you all know this story, right? Into a kior, or a dud, or a kalachas, or a parur. What do these four words mean? They all seem to be a... What would you say the one word that captures all four of them? What? Some kind of plea that you cook meat in. Now look, every language produces a lot of words. Would you say a cauldron is bigger than a pot? Okay, you get it? And there are different sized pots, but there are four different words you find in English translations to these things. But why? Why tell me this? So that's the mitzvah. Right? The more unusual, the more out of the ordinary, the story sounds. That's the mutzvah. And sometimes you need a tradition of what happened. Right? How is it that the prophet most beloved in Tanakh, who would you say is the most beloved prophet? Most people hated the prophets and didn't listen to them. But there's one prophet that was profoundly beloved to everybody. He spends his whole life just running around Israel performing mitzvahs for people and helping them. He turns bitter water to sweet. He gives bread to everyone who's starving. Who am I talking about? Not Eliyahu, but his student, Elisha. So what's that crazy story where some kids call him a baldy, and he turns around, gets two bears to come out of a forest that doesn't exist in Beit El, never did, and kills 42 children? I wonder how that looked in the morning papers. Okay. I'm just giving what I think is the craziest example of Mutzpah. What is going on there? 42? You couldn't say 40? The more crazy you get with cases like this, in narratives, the more you really have to figure out what's going on. But the Bible is read on multiple levels, of course. Pshat is pshat. Okay. The Bible does not tell us why such a beloved man would take such exception at being called a baldy. Bald man. Alei Kerei. The Gemara says he created the forest so that the bears could come out. What? Two bears? Before this semester is over, I'm going to give you a page to this story that you're going to like. Okay? And I'm not going to cheat you. I think that 42 children did die there. But my interpretation is going to depend on a certain tradition of what was going on there. Based on the Mutzpan. The Mutzpan doesn't mean that I have to rely on a tradition that says something that's not hinted in the Torah. The story has context. There's a story right beforehand. There's a story right afterwards. And the kids are in the middle of that. Okay? So why do you think it tells you four different sized pots? That's a mitzvah. Okay? And I don't know if everyone who's inspired to go so far in their studies to get into GPATS is going to one day be a teacher. Maybe you will be. Certainly to your own children. You know, you're going to sit and do homework with someone one day, maybe. Alright? So that's the challenge to find a good interpretation of the Mutzpah. And this book tells you how the rules and the categories, right? Which I'm not saying I capture everything here, but this pamphlet that tells you the word choice, trends, and patterns. Okay. Would anyone like to suggest? It goes from smallest to largest. If you put a fork, and I assure you, this was not just a fork, right? It was probably a pitchfork, right? Okay. Kachim are sacrifices are cooked afterwards for food for the Kohanim, right? If you stick the same fork in this pot as you do for this pot, or vice versa, this pot is for this, you're going to take every bit of the meat that this person had for this small. This pot was for a big 3-year-old cow that you brought for chatas. This pot may be for a 2-month-old sheep that you brought for a shlomim. In other words, it's the Tanakh's way of exacerbating their sin. Maybe just because that's the way it was. Right? As you're talking about Galui Mutzpan, about finding the Mutzpan. So from the word Tzafon, which means hidden. The Lord is hidden way out of nowhere. So Matzpunim are called treasures because you hide treasures. Safun is where you hide the Atikoma, and back there. So this is a book by Dr. Yomi Grossman. He teaches at Rigawa, he teaches at Kibosh. So some of it that it's worthwhile at least to recognize. Okay, this is his most recent book. It's called the Lugimutzvan. And the point of it is to recognize the Lugimutzvan, where the Tanakh is telling you with just one hint, one word. Wow, that's like a background that creates, that's a milat mancha, that's what creates a background. Why are you using the word ish so much? Right? Can you just in your mind think about a woman who is preparing a basket? She's probably very, very sad, very upset, and yet maybe exhilarated that he's going to live if I do this. She's preparing a basket and she's putting in the pitch, and she's rubbing, making it. Preparing it so that it won't sink as soon as you let it eat it in the water, right? You all know the story I'm talking about, right? The terminologies used in her preparation, and not only the preparation, but the word that Tanakh, the Torah uses to describe this basket, I wouldn't use that word usually, should remind the reader of what? Noah. Right? That's a mitzvah. What is she doing? Yeah, but what is she actually doing? She's saving the world. No less than Noah. Because this man is going to challenge the notion that human beings can be made into beasts of burden to serve the will of other people without gaining anything from the world. That's the first thing Moshe does. Have you ever remembered why God chose him? Because he chased after him.
I
didn't think
I was
scared.
I thought
it
was just
saying
that he's
brisk. There are five different opinions of the Medrash. That's the one you know because, someone tell me?
Because.
That's the one Rashi makes now. Rashi's the filter of the Medrash. How did rocks become one under Yaakov's head? Four different opinions appear in Midrash. But you know the one that Rashi mentions. Which is that they fought with one another to be Allah and the Tzadik is Rosh. But in the precious Rabbah, there are other opinions. So Rashi has become, now but that's the way it is, a sort of a filter for the Midrash we need to know. So yes, she's saving the world. No less than Noah. And that's the thing that we're dealing with. So Moshe becomes, God chooses him. The Medrash I'm talking about is where he chases after a sheep into the desert. Because he's scaring, he's going to die first, and the elements, and he brought back the gist, and he picked it up. God said, that's the man I want. In other words, he's compassionate. There's another medrash that says he took the sheep far into the desert, so he drachet mina gozel, to be normal. Right? Another medrash says that he went bin bodein, to be spiritual. He's also a man of great conviction. Right? He stands up for everyone, the loser in all these stories. Underdog. That's the mitzvah. Why is the Torah giving me this extra information, more than I need to know, about how this woman prepared a basket for her son? I can imagine what you need to do to make sure a boy is not going to sink into the water. The weight of the child will make him sink right into the water. So, because she's saving the world. These are examples of mitzvah. Okay. Now, I want to introduce you to about five or six important authors before we get into some materials here. The next one that I want to do is James Cullen. Right? This one's called Potiphar's House, and why he chooses this picture for his cover and stuff.
What's the cover?
It's Potiphar's wife naked in bed.
Yeah.
Why is that the cover? But they're inside, huh?
Show Potiphar's living.
It's crazy. And this is how to read the Bible. Yes, it is. Okay. So it's voluminous. So I would say the way that this author, and he's written many other books of this sort, the way that this author has distinguished himself is to use ancient sources before Chazal to a greater extent than anybody else. I know at first, perhaps to be an observant Jew, which is very rare in these circles, you get skewered in biblical archaeological review for being too fundamentalists, let's say, you know. I can't tell you that there's no kfirah in his books, because there is. Kfirah being that the Torah doesn't emanate from Har Sinai, or in its current, something resembling its current state. Okay. But be it as it may, what he does is he uses the sources that you're not likely to find in your traditional. I have this book in my office at Shore. It's called The Bible As It Was. The Bible As It Was. That's where he really uses what I'm telling you now. He uses the Dead Sea Scrolls, he uses the pseudepigrapha, the full apocrypha, even the New Testament, for goodness sake. See, there's sources in the New Testament. There's a famous source in the New Testament that sheds light on events at the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha. Because in the New Testament, Avraham goes twice to Israel. Shabbos does in Parshas Noach, but it elaborates in the New Testament. It says he went and it didn't work, and you try to make aliyah, you don't buy a farm, if you rent an apartment for 6 months, it didn't work, so he went back, Terah went back to the family. And then God told Abraham, now I want you to go yourself. Okay. Interesting is that the Medrash says, Lech Lecha. And he says, I give you a dispensation to leave your father's house to go to this to leave Mesopotamia and go to Canaan. Implying that, and amazingly, Rav Moshe Feinstein uses this in a tshuva. A parent who wrote to him that my child wants to make aliyah and I don't want him to, because he has to listen to me. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, yes. Passing to the child, don't make aliyah unless it's okay with the parents. It's a very good lesson. Because it says in the Medrash, Lech Lecha, you have my permission to leave your father to make aliyah, implying that other people don't. Maybe that's not the pshat in it, but okay, we should use that. If I'd Yosef had answered the same truth, but very differently, he said, living in Israel is a mitzvah chiyuvis, and you can't tell your child to violate a mitzvah. Moshe Feinstein class them like the Rambam that living in Israel is not a mitzvah chiyuvis, it's a mitzvah kiyumis. Right? It's like not putting up a mezuzah if you live in a cave. Well, then I know it's not a mitzvah. Anyway, you see how midrashim are used. But I digress. James Kugel uses pre-Chazal that continues. The question is, you want to ask me, is it worthwhile to be allowed to do that? So I will tell you that now, I don't have it here, but there was a 10-volume book called Legends of the Jews. Legends of the Jews. Louis Rabinowitz. Be aware of it. It's very worthwhile. For one of my sons, bar mitzvah, someone got me the whole set, which has been republished in two volumes. Two big green volumes. Like this big. It's incredible what is in this book. It's starts with creation, it ends with, I believe, Megillat Esther, and it runs the entire Bible using the just incredible breadth of source material cited in this book. If you want to know why Haman built the gallows to hang Mordechai from the wood of the table that somehow he got his hands on, Noah's table, look it up here. It's an incredible index in the back. There is such a midrash. And then there's another midrash that he built it not, you know, he didn't have such old wood. He used the wood from the base of Mikdash that was recently destroyed. He used that wood. Why would any chazal make up such a crazy midrash? What's the mutzpah? There's always mutzpah. Is that the Tanakh cares to tell me how tall the gallows were. And you know what? It's the same height as the table and the same height as the base of the bush. 50 amos. That's it. Now, I could be wrong. Maybe that's not it. But you know, that's what Mefarshim do. Rashi says this is what it means. Tosfos says, nah, you're wrong. Something else. Now, it's important to know how big the table was and how big the front of the base of Mikdash was, but I don't know why it's important to know how tall the gallows were. Who cares? Maybe you wanted to say it so you could see it from very far. 50 amos is about as tall as the Lachlan. And that's a tall gallows to hang one person on. It also explains how they got Haman and all his 10 sons on that same gallows. Because if it was just for Mordechai, you get 10 people on it. Because Haman was hanging on his own guitar because he wanted to show off to everybody, I'm hanging this Jew so high. It's just well set to hang you and all 10 of them the next day. Anyway, that's your challenge. Be as creative as you can be. And then the Tanakh becomes like just pulling in your hand. It's like the Tanakh becomes like yeah, you can mold it. Right? So that's called Legends of the Jews, Ginsburg. I have some questions here. I'll stop for myself. Do you have a question?
No, I have a question. How do you make sure that you're not being too creative in the
Tanakh? So the answer to that, it always came up in my narrative. That's because your good intentions. Could you be wrong? It's possible to be wrong, but you know what, there's something called Eilu Ve'Eilu. I'll give you an example that often comes up. I love doing this with you because I know you're all Kios.
Is for
wife. To get wife. she doesn't want to talk about Asa, and she doesn't want to visit this, because she doesn't want her husband to know that she was behind him. She doesn't want to ever talk about this. So otherwise, Yitzchak can say, why should we send Yaakov away? We said for you, so let's send him to Esau. Then we have to put him through all that. Right? You get it? So Rivka is very good at manipulating every situation. So she gets, right? What's beautiful about, she calls it, said, you go for your mim achodim, which is the plural of that. Right? What else do these words appear in the gracious? Your mim achodim. It's incredible. This is one of the best books ever written on this topic. The person who wrote this book just passed away a few weeks ago. Dear friend, his name is David Sykes. Just that, I don't know what he would say. We taught here in the early 80s. When I was a senior here, I wasn't actually signed up for this class, but when I was a senior at YU, 1982, he had a family emergency and had to leave like a few days before the semester. And they asked me to teach the class. I could have been enrolled in the class. I was a senior and they asked me to teach a class. It was Yom Yahu. So it was a big thrill. So when I graduated, they said, you want to wear the march with the procession of the teachers or march with the students? And I chose the students. That was my... And then they asked me to teach the next semester. And I'm a teaching student. Okay, so Rabbi David... Is it Rabbi? Yeah. David Sykes. You see the name of the book, Patterns of Genesis and Beyond. It's based on his doctoral thesis. And there's nothing that comes close to his ingenuity at connecting trends, in especially in relations to Genesis. Okay. Where else does this word appear? So this book is filled with these kind of things. When Yaakov was working for Rachel for 7 years, it says, "Vayiyu ki yomim achodim ba'agasos." He said, I would just be here for a few days. 7 years is not a few days. Yeah, but he loved her so much that they were like, yomim achodim. Oh. It's such an odd terminology, yomim achodim. Just an odd terminology. It appears twice in the Torah. One, when Rivka tells Yaakov how long you should stay there. And two, when the Torah describes what it felt like to work for something. For something that didn't fall into storage. Now, the Chizkuni, right? Chizkuni of Ashkenazic in the school of Rashi. The Chizkuni says, wait a second. When you're doing that, a few days feels like 7 years, not vice versa. 7 years should have felt like 700 years. What does it say 7 years for a few days? But I was so slow. So here is where we run into drash, like I'm about to do a shot. Okay. Chizkuni says that the Oso is not talking about Rachel. It's talking about that would be amazing. No, that's not what he says. It's a word that doesn't appear in the pasuk. But does as a verb, not as a noun. It says in the pasuk, "Vayavod ba'ad Rachel," worked for Rachel, and the work lasted like a few days. 7 years lasted like a few days because he loved it so much. Osa, which should be hard, meaning Rachel. But the Chizkuni says that the Osa actually goes on the feminine word avod. Yaakov was working for the first time in his life, and he enjoyed it.
This also relates well to the fact that he's becoming an Esau of Yaakov hybrid with Rachel.
Yes. As soon as you said, "Anochi Esau Bechorecha," Yoch of the Order. That mentorship out there, the sister's crying, or Leah's crying because she gets the older brother. And as soon as you said, Anochi is the Forecha, what is the king coming to say Satsir is the Anochi? Right? No, we don't. You see, he says, what is the king? Bim Komein. You see the shtuff is? You see how he's sticking his elbow into Yaakov's stomach with that word? Right? You're getting it? In our place, we don't put younger ones before the old. I know why you had to leave your house. Yaakov told him, actually.
He's really putting it in his place in Kohen.
Yes. Alright? You get it? But you're saying you Komeinu. In our place, we don't do this discourteous thing of having a younger brother step up in front of his older brother and take his place. Right? So, and what's interesting is that the two sisters are constantly referred to as Kitana and Gedol, right? Rachel Bitcha, Kitana, Nei Rachel Bitcha, right? Kitana and Gedol. But when Lavan confronts Yaakov with his, you know, why did I trick you? Lo yosef kei du komeinu lo seis, what does he change it to? He doesn't say lo seis a katana lifnei agadol. He uses more charged words. Now, Lavan was almost definitely speaking Aramaic when he said these words. I said, almost definitely? No question about it. He's speaking Aramaic. I don't know if Lavan speaks Hebrew. Right? These conversations are translated into Hebrew for the Hebrew reader of the Torah. There's even a little Aramaic at the end of the story where they named the rock, right? Yudar Sahadusa, right? Dalei. So, I don't know what word he used in Aramaic, but Hashem tells Moshe, I want you to write the words, L'seis ha-tse'ira b'fnei ha-bachira. You get it? These two words are much more charged in our story than these two words. Does everybody agree? Rav Ya'avod Tzair. Anochi Esav Bechorecha. He doesn't say Anochi Esav HaGadol. This book by David Sachs, try to get it if you can. I don't think it's still great, but it recently came out. Right?
Will they sell it at the store or something?
I hope so, most definitely. Yeah.
Okay. If there were like three sparring you can get, what three sparring would you say to get?
Well, my sparring. You mean on this topic?
Yeah.
I haven't introduced you to everything here yet. You certainly should get something by Rim Zorn. She has more than this, but I just...
What's her name?
Aviva Zornberg, do you familiar with her? My people is called Beginnings of Desire. She always has cute names.
Zornberg.
Maybe she's just, that's funny, she's just maybe over the hill. She was so famous 30 years ago.
My mom
is over the hill. No, everybody who's 60 or above, she's like one of the world experts in the Bible and the Bible of marriage. She's very special. She was made famous by a public television special by Bill Moyers. You know who that is? Channel 13 used to be called Public Television. I don't know what the television is now. But he had a special, a 10-week program. Each week was a few hours of Muslims, Christians, and Jews talking about stories of Bereshis. And she was amongst them, and she was the only one of the 10, certainly the only Jew, who was... She was certainly the most learned, most respectful of the narratives. right? It was the provost of JTS. I can't even say the words he said about Hashem and Abraham in this thing. It was so despicable how the head of a Jewish smicha giving organization. So I can't say the words. It's so bad. It's so bad. Can I just say the Russian tables? He says, God is a mean and he said SOB. How do you say that on public television? That's what you head of an organization, say things about God. And it was only bad things to say about Abraham. Really? Other religions revere Abraham. I have to have the Muslims speaking with more reverence about Abraham than me. But Aviva Zornberg just shone through every report from right to left that wrote about it, said so glowingly how she came through. Thank God that she was a woman. She was scholar residence in my show a number of times, but 25 years ago. So it's sad that how is someone like that not known to, you know, and you're the future of, you know.
Well, to be fair, I don't think I've
ever
really been, especially in classes, I've
never
really been introduced to
other. Okay, fair enough.
But now you know.
No, exactly. Okay, please. I'm trying to get some. So that's one. Zornberg. Two, I would say, get something from James Kogel and be careful, you know, what you mean. And David Sykes. And if you can handle the Hebrew, this one is as good to go to the mitzvah. Right? You're going to be experts at uncovering the mitzvah. The two stages. Uncovering it, and then what do you do with it? What do I do with a story about a beloved prophet who kills 42 kids? Right? Now there's one book here I have not discussed yet, and that's... I copied, maybe you can do this again, like what you did with the Reddison's article. I just copied about 20 pages or so from David Sykes' book that I want you to look at over the next few weeks. Okay, it has to do with Dublin, right? Okay, you can see a trend here, because Dublin is going to be our really go-to guy as we start to get into the nitty-gritty of textbook, right? Maybe that's not fair, because some of you learned Shmuel Bet last year, but it's going to be from a different direction. So that's this. The other one had a lot about Michal, so you can do whatever you need with that. The last thing I want you to, and it's a shame, I didn't have the other book that I want to introduce you to that's like this. This is Tzvi Adar, or John and Sarna, does that ring a bell? Understanding Genesis? He has a book called also Understanding Exodus. This is what this book and Sarna are doing, which is very valuable. Certainly not limited to these authors. I've taught whole courses on what I'm about to describe to you. But what they do is, in order to really fully appreciate what's going on, let's say this was Parsha. Let me choose something from this was Parsha. What's going on with the book? Let's start with it. So this Adar, Sarna, and the like, and I take them because they're a little more traditional than what you're going to find from, you know, the Christian world or others who are interested in learning Genesis, is that you can't really fully appreciate what's going on in Bereishis Tetz Zayin unless you know the conventions of this, the background of the story at that time in history. Now, chances are the Vilna Gaon did not know that. He did not know Hittite law about selling land in Israel. Does that mean that he's lacking in the full understanding of Parshas Chayisara, where Avraham wants to buy land from Bnei Ches? I don't want to go there. I'm just saying that we should fill our minds with as much information as we have. The Vilna Gaon did not know biblical archaeology. It wasn't a science yet. Right? But here is what Tzvi Adar does. Here is what John Sarna does, and they do it very concise. Right? The thing is that they don't have footnotes. Someone has like tiny little footnotes here and there, but they don't really need footnotes. Everything is like is basically you know, it tells you where in Gracious, where in the Nuzi tablets, where in you know, or in the Shnuna or the Bishkar or going to Hammurabi or whatever else you have to look there in their cycle. Okay? In the body itself. So when you read out something like this without footnotes, you're gonna say, well, what is this? It makes it an easier read, that's for sure. Okay. Now this is not something you can just fabricate, of course. It's something that is well documented in rules in Sumerian, Babylon, and Egypt. That if a woman goes many years without giving birth, right, she shall choose a replacement for her husband to bear a child for her to keep. It becomes her child. It's a surrogate mother. Incredibly, that's the way Ibn Ezra explains our story. The Ibonemi mena means, I will take her child after she gives birth to him. And I will raise that child. Rashi couldn't stand that. And when Rashi says Ibonemi mena means, maybe, this is his life, maybe I will be zoche to have my own child because of this incredibly selfless thing I just did. Swarnum says something incredible that's still debated today, but mostly people come on one side, is that when I contemplate that there is a woman who is being intimate with my husband, whatever in my body or mind that's preventing me from conceiving will be cleared up. He calls it from the jealousy that I'll have from her. In other words, can there be psychological barriers to conception? That's debated. But if a couple never has a 12% chance of conception and a good frame of mind gives them a now 17%, that's something. If the clinical definition of infertility is to not succeed in conceiving for 1 year, not 10, but 21. All right, so Sarah is suffering. She wants to alleviate her suffering. And for all of the witnesses we see, I actually once engaged in a dialogue by a JCC on this topic. And true to form, just like Ismar Sorsch from GTS, there I said his name, the person I was debating with was saying how what a mean, wicked woman Sara is behaving like, to send her out of the house and to afflict her, right? So I have to tell you, you should understand. Judge Sarah, this is an important thing today, not by what you feel your standards are for surrogate motherhood today, but by the standards of the conventions of the day. Sarah is acting extremely righteously in this story. Because what does she say? She says, Goratius, Amazos, which doesn't mean cast her out, it means free her. Free her. Gabership is a lashon of freedom. That's the lashon that Mar uses for freeing a slave. Goratius Amma means free her and let her take the child. That's not the rule in ancient world. The rule in ancient world is, yes, if the woman gave birth to a child for you, and she was a bondswoman, and you don't want her around, you have to free her. But you keep the child. Now, it's true, at the end of the story, Sarah doesn't really want the child, because by that time she has her own. Right? But she lets the woman leave with the child. That's not the ancient convention. Get out of my house. I hate you. You're making my life miserable. And don't take your child with you. I can keep him or I can sell him. That's what you did in the ancient world. So you're going to say what you want to say, but what Adar, Sarna give us is a running commentary of that particular story and what's going on in the ancient world at the time. Okay? Everyone good? Now, what's the bad interpretation of Eshkol? I gave you the general perush. Why should I lose both of you on the same day? So before we get into the first thing we did this semester was philology, word choice, what the words mean. You can't explain a story without being correct on the words, right? But here there's also a context. She's telling Yaakov, get out of here. Why should I lose both of you on the same day? Before we can explain anything, who are the two people that she's afraid of losing on the same day? Yaakov, I don't want your brother to kill you. You know, there's a story in Shmuel Bet about a woman, a wise woman from Tekoa, who goes to David and tells her a story about one son of hers who kills another son, and now the girl Hadad wants to kill this son, and she that kind of had a and you're going to leave me without anybody. My husband is dead. My one son is dead. Now I just have one other son. Please don't let the girl Hadad kill this son. You know the great example? Okay. So that seems to be what's going on here. That's how all the Mephoshim and Rashi explains. Okay? Why should I lose you and Esav on the same day? What's the basic assumption of saying that? Why should Esav die the day he kills Yaakov? What's the assumption? That if Esav kills Yaakov, some relative will now kill Esav and I lose both my sons. Like the woman in Shmuel Bet was afraid of. It was a whole concocted story by Yoav to get Avshalom to be invited back into the kingdom. But, okay, everybody agree that that's... problem is that, again, it's the Chizkuni who says that, I don't see, why is it that just because Esav kills Yaakov that Esav is going to die that day? And you know, what Goel Adam is going to kill him? Yitzchak. Nachor's children? No. What did Esav say about wanting to kill Yaakov? Remember? Yokum Evel Yitzchok Ovi V'ahargo Es Yaakov Ochi. After all, Daddy told me, I don't know when I'm going to die. So Daddy must think he's going to die soon. Yitzchok lived almost another 60 years after this. But Daddy said, Lo Yodati Yom Osi. Esav has more respect for his father here than Yosef's brothers did. Right? I'm not going to kill my brother as much as I hate him and as angry as I am with him now. I'm not going to kill him while Daddy's alive, because as much as I hate him, I do acknowledge the pain that would cause my dad. I didn't think the same thing about his mother, but okay. But he says, Yokum Evel Yitzchok Ovi V'ahargo Es Yaakov Ochi. Now, what can this possibly mean? When she said, why should I lose the two of you on the same day? Chiddush, which is? Why should I lose my husband and one of my sons on the same day? Same day I'm burying my husband, I have to worry my son, one of my sons is going to die. Remember? By the way, this now Bechor Shor, a little earlier than Chizkun, but also from the same kind of Parshanut. I'd say Bechor Shor is between Rashbam and Rashi. Yeah. Bechor Shor was Yosef of Orleans. It's mentioned quite often in Tosfos. Get this thing, it's excellent. Bechor Shor, the Torah, is a new Mosad Rav Kook in the room, 20 years old. Mosad Rav Kook by excellent. Okay, for sure. Because a lot of Chizkuni, a lot of the Dasakinim, the Hadar Zakinim, a lot of the Balei Tosfos, kind of Panei Haroza, the Sefer Gan, a lot of them are in the mold of the Mahoshua. He says that when Yaakov heard that Esau was approaching him with 400 men, and the messenger didn't say anything. He just said, he's coming with 400 men to meet you. Yaakov, his fear is the worst. He has to hope for the best, and I don't want to insult my brother to make him think I think he's trying to kill me, but I still have to prepare just in case he is. At the end, Mahoshua says that, no, Esau never intended to kill him, but he wants to show him that he could. So when he thinks that he's going to kill me, it says, remember what Rashi does with those two expressions? Like a Golda Meir kind of thing she once said at the UN, I can forgive the Arabs for killing my boys, but I can't forgive them for making my boys kill them. What does Rashi say? Lest Esav kill his whole household. Vayetzerlo, Shema Yaharog. He's going to make me kill. He's going to make me fight back, and I might have to kill him. Beautiful Rashi. What a beautiful Rashi. Choshor says no. If we should agree with Rashi that those two words are not just parallelistic, and that each one needs to be explained in a different way, Vayiro, Esav wants to kill me. Vayetzerlo, that must be that daddy's dead. Because mommy said that he would never try to kill me unless daddy was dead. Right? Unless he can say it changes his mind. Knows what's in Esav's head. Okay. So now you see, Lo eshkal gam shnichem yom echol is a big chiddush. Why should I lose you, Yaakov, on the same day that I bury my husband? And I submit to you that as clever as that sounds, it's wrong. Look at the words it's on the line. It's wrong. What do you think, guys?
Well, it's gam shnichem. So it's blank and also me too. It's 1 plus 2.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay, Hanushah, Esau. But here's why it can't be it. Because this is a very, very specific word. It's a rare word. It's used in Tanakh only to describe who's the child. Okay. I'm going to refer to this another thing with this short shem of Han. Okay? It's very rare. We're telling you 5 or 6 times. Famous one, Dov Shakul. Bear. Try to take the cubs from a bear. We know that. That's going to be bear. Okay. So in review, right? Kugel for ancient material, not really ancient, like that's Adar and Sarn. Kugel is very good at just using whatever was available to Chazal, and that was Legends of the Jews, where you can find just about anything in the index that's worthy to have. The patterns, data sites, right? I didn't really tell you so much about Aviva Zornberg and her style. It's just that she's it's sort of like using all these things together. Of course, she has to use patterns in her understanding of creation because it's you can't deny it. But what she does better than anyone else is that she appears to be fully steeped in the literature of everything. Fully steeped in English literature, French literature. And she'll use to explain a story with Yosef and his brothers from Anna Karenina or from War and Peace. I don't know where she gets this stuff from. She must have read 4,000 books in the world of books today. Sort of the way Jonathan Sacks from the Rock of New York City this week uses a lot of English literature to make points. I prefer to make the point from a, you know, Medrash Chazal, but okay, if it's something out there, okay. So this today I'm really doing a lot of just to give you the background of what's worthy to use. You know, in Yaakov, I'll give you an example of something David Sacks says. He says,
the
two nations that wouldn't give us bread and water in the desert. And what's fascinating is that, and the Mechilta Pasuk is this way, Rashi says this in a few places in this parish, is that Amalek can convert. Someone, a man or a woman from Amalek says, I don't want to be like Amalek anymore. I want to join the Jewish people. You can. Only an Amalek Moabite can't. Males can find out later. Yes. Wow. Why would you be more harsh with Amalek and Moab? And if God was so interested in just having bread and water when he left Egypt, why didn't he just put up tables with cold spring water and some sandwiches right there for all of us? God can just do that and do it. No, but you see what the Kodesh Baruch Hu wants is human agency. To help one human help, have one human help another. So, Ad Khan in the Medrash, 42 children, you know, there were 42 journeys in the desert. We were stuck in the desert because of Amalek and Moab. Amalek and Moab had given us bread and water when we left. And they owe us more than any other nation. They're our closest relatives. Not for Avram and Lot, we've been destroyed 3 or 4 times. They were so kafui tov that we can't have them in our genes, so to say. If Amalek and Moab had given us bread and water when we left Egypt, there would never have been Hayesh Hashem Kribeinu Ma'ayin. There never would have been Biyutein Luseinu Bamidbar. There never would have been any of this. And people would say, so God, why didn't you give us these things? Because that's not what I want. I don't want you to be just dependent on what I give you all the time. I want you to be thankful. I want people who need people. I don't know. That was part of the plan. There would never have been an Amalek. And the Jews had help from outside, by the way. But alas, Philistines didn't step forth either, but Philistines didn't owe you like Amalek owed you. Those are the 42 children. It's something, it's cryptic, it's mutzvah to be sure. But that's the challenge. That's what you're all up for. Okay? Try to get week 3 in time sometime this week, right? And for Tuesday, please read this. Read the insights. Sorry that it's a little different than the specificity I gave you last year. But try to work on week 4, which is on Shmuel Bet. So we have Shmuel Bet, some more Shmuel, like you had from Mayor Steinberg. It was Art of Reticence. No, I'm sorry, that was Rubble. And then I'm going to Jerusalem next week. I want to finish this Chuberet with you, whatever is in here. This is the material here for you. And then we'll do mostly from then on, second half of the semester will be inside text. Okay, since you've been gracious already with someone, we'll do some Shoftim, some Divrayam along the way. Okay.
If possible, could we go more for like the non-Shmuel Degrayim, just because we did that last year?
Yeah, sure.
For
sure.
Rabbi, we just class did
Shmuel. Maybe give some Yom Shmuel. Shmuel Shoftim.
And Yirmiyahu.
Yirmiyahu was good too. Miss the narrative in Yirmiyahu. Okay, good.
Thanks for
trying. Bye-bye, baby.
Have a good Shabbos.
You're welcome.